Hello and welcome to the latest episode of The Wagon, with me, Finty Williams, and my colleague and genius friend, John McEwan, who has been an addiction therapist for 30 years. As always, we're here to help lift the shame and secrecy that surrounds addicts and allow people to be proud and loud to say that they're in recovery. As always, this is only possible with the help of Abitha Calm, a residential clinic specialising in addictions and mental health. Without their support, this podcast would definitely not have been possible. You can find out more about their fabulous work at www.abithacalm.com. Joining us today is the amazing Matt Willis. Matt is a singer, songwriter, TV presenter and actor who, I have to say, I was lucky enough to see you in Little Shop of Horrors, which I adored. But probably best known for being the bassist and one of the vocalists of the band Busted, who I've also seen. He's been married for 13 years and you have three children.
Yeah, three now, yeah.
You don't look old enough to have even one.
Well, I feel it.
Thank you so much for being here.
No, thanks for having me. It's a really great thing. I'm pleased to be here.
Thanks so much for coming on. And, as usual, we were prepared enough to look at what you've already spoken about publicly, so we didn't really want to go into stuff that you hadn't really touched on or stuff that you're not comfortable with. But
and
you're very open and honest about your journey through addiction in the sort of different ways that it can progress on people. And I was fascinated and I sort of identified myself with the fact that you realised, or did you realise, or did you look back and see the signs, I think you said age seven, that you were already kind of looking for ways to maybe get a little buzz or a little high out of things. Is that right? Was it seven?
Yeah, I realised it when I was talking to some people about recovery, and I was kind of like, I was just thinking to myself, when was the first time that I kind of altered my mood, through something? And I remember being really young, like probably about seven, maybe younger, and being in my bed, and I had like asthma as a kid. I still have it now, but very mild. But I remember being a kid under my bed with my cover pulled over my head and taking as many hits of my blue aspirin head as I possibly could. Wow. And when I got to as many so I couldn't suck in any more air, my head would throb and it would make all my my arms tingle and my fingers tingle. And it was kind of a horrible feeling, but I kept doing it. And I did it every night. Like I remember my family constantly taking me to the doctors saying this boy's got such bad asthma because he's rinsing aspirin inhalers all the time. But I was just there in my bed like at night kind of like just taking as many hits as I could, and I kind of and I didn't think about that for 25 years, and suddenly I remembered it and I was like, oh my God, I was that young and already wanting, not being able to cope with the way I felt and choosing to deal with that by making myself not feel that way through a different substance.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because for some people, not all people, who end up with addiction problems, it does start at a very early age. And when did it then progress, or did you start smoking when you were young? Tobacco? Were you drinking when you were young?
I remember drink was probably the first thing that hit me. I think that was about probably 11 years old, and me and my friends would kind of go to the park, and I hung out with some kind of guys who were a bit older than me, and we kind of get 2 liter bottles of cider and try and drink as much as you possibly could. And I would just drink until I was sick and then just keep drinking. So like, it was from my first time drinking, I already didn't drink like other people, because other people would drink and feel a bit sick and stop, whereas I would drink, feel a bit sick, sometimes be sick and carry on drinking. You know, it would kind of, I don't know if that was alcoholism yet, because I wasn't doing it as progressively as it got to, but I definitely, what they talk about as an allergic response in a way. You know, I had something happen to me where I had something inside of me and a craving kicked in where I couldn't control what happened from that moment on. And that carried on with many different substances in my early teens. I kind of got into smoking weed with some friends, and that I became obsessed with. You know, I kind of that was a big part of my life. Till I was about 17, I could start going to pubs, because before then I couldn't really drink that much because I was too young. You know, you couldn't drink in the UK, so but I could smoke weed in garages and my friends' back gardens and the park and stuff like that, which we did every single night.
Every night.
Really?
Every night for years and years and years and years and years. That was a big part of my life. And if we didn't have any, or I didn't have any, it was a big deal. You know, like, it was a big deal. Like, and you know, I could probably go a few days without having it or something, but it was definitely on me. Like, I wanted to smoke weed. I wanted to change the way I felt.
Mm. You noticed when it wasn't there, clearly.
Oh, I know. Yeah, when it wasn't there, I felt uncomfortable. Like, if I knew I had, always running out of money was a big deal, you know. So we'd find ways to kind of, I had like loads of little jobs and things like that. I'd spend all my money on weed. And then I got to about 16, I think, and I started getting served in some local pubs, and that's when drinking got hold. And I think I think everyone but me knew that I didn't drink like everyone else. Like, and from a very early age, I was always drunk, you know, like I was always, but in kind of a way which people quite liked, you know. I was kind of the, you know, for years and years, I was the guy that you wanted at your party because I was the guy who would get the party going, you know, and I liked that, you know, because for someone who, you know, felt, you know, immensely uncomfortable in himself and kind of constantly, really in a world of self-hatred, you know, like I found something which changed the way I felt, and actually people liked me and I liked being around people, which was a new feeling for me. And I liked being at that position in a party where I could kind of control things, and I was the guy that people liked to hang out with or drink with, you know. And and that went on for a while until that became the complete opposite, where people didn't want me around. People didn't want me to party with them. They definitely didn't want to drink with me. And I didn't want to drink with you if you didn't drink like me, you know. So it was, but from a very young age, alcohol did for me, you know, something which I couldn't do for myself.
Yeah.
You know,
lots of people talk about that feeling of discomfort or not fitting in, not belonging, not being popular, either whether it's because they have some sort of social anxiety or they just don't feel cool enough. I mean, you've talked about this, Vince, haven't you?
So many times.
Quite a lot.
So many times. Not cool enough, not funny enough, not pretty enough, not tall enough, not slim enough, you know, not intelligent enough.
Yeah.
So, but put a pint in my hand and that was it.
Yeah.
Exactly the same as you. You finally feel in control of something because you can buy drinks for people and, you know, and they hang out with you because you've bought them drinks. Mm. You know, it's so delusional, really.
It is.
How do you see that, obviously psychologically or from a psychological point of view, do you see that as what some people call the ism of alcoholism or addiction, addictive personality, or do you see that as something that stemmed from your childhood or have you had many thoughts on that?
Well, I've been in therapy for a while, kind of like recently, to kind of readdress some things which I've never really gone to, which has involved my childhood and my upbringing. And I've kind of been looking at that a little bit more because it's somewhere I've never really, like, I've been in recovery a while now and I I've never really gone there, you know. And as soon as I went there, I was like, oh there's a lot to unravel here, you know. And actually, this is going to take a lot longer than I thought it was going to take, you know. But so I'm kind of I'm in the middle of that right now, you know. And it is, you know, I don't know, because I speak to people who, you know, are alcoholics and drug addicts all the time, and some people have the same experience as me. Some people have very different experiences as me. Mm. You know, I think it's something which affects people in different ways and from different backgrounds and different. You know, you don't have to have had a traumatic upbringing to be an alcoholic. You don't have to have had I meet people who have had the most incredible time growing up and they still can't put that down, you know. So it's I don't know what it is, I just know that I've got it.
Yeah. And when did that hit home first, Matt? When did you realize? Because again, it sounds like you kind of would have wrestled with, you know, being popular, then being unpopular, then I guess at some stage knowing that you had to stop, or maybe it was people around you saying, Matt, come on, it's time to give this in now. I mean, what was your process there?
I think during Busted, when we first came out, drinking had already got a massive hold of me. And but I was suddenly in an industry where it was completely acceptable to drink at 12 o'clock. You know, and I was kind of, it was, it was kind of cool. Do you know what I mean? To have a beer and, you know, photo shoot at 12:30 p.m. You know, it was kind of okay. You know, and actually, I don't know if that is true. I just took it upon myself to go, this is cool and this is okay, you know, because it facilitated me to drink whenever I wanted to, you know. But people were always pulling me aside from a very early age and going, Matt, I think you have a problem here. You know, you need to look at this, you know. But it didn't affect my work or my life at that moment. I could still get up. I was always the first on the bus. I was always the first, you know, at work. You know, I'd never miss a day and I'd always be there, you know. I'd be hungover to death and looking and feeling terrible, but I'd be there, you know. And I took what they were saying and I was kind of like, well, yeah, I do drink quite heavily, you know, but I like it. I like partying. That's kind of who I am. That's the guy I am, you know. And then I think Busted ended and I had a bit of time without having a focus, you know, without having something that got me up in the morning, without having something that was a driving force in my life. And I was left to myself, you know. And I had someone much wiser than me once tell me that your head is a dangerous place and never go there without an adult present. And I can't thank you enough, because it was a big thing for me. Suddenly having that time to think and that time to kind of reflect on what's going on was, you know, catastrophic for me. And it kind of and things got bad really quickly. You know, and in the meantime, I just got signed and was kind of releasing a solo album. Well, in the middle of writing and recording a solo album, which was new for me, because I'd always wrote with other people. I'd always wrote with my bandmates, and I've been in the band since I was 16. I'd never done anything by myself. I'd never been in a writing session on my own, you know, and I didn't feel adequate. I felt, you know, I didn't really want to do a solo album, if I'm honest. I didn't really want to do any of it, but I didn't know what else to do with my life. I was like, everything that I knew had suddenly stopped. Mm-hmm. So I was doing this new thing and I wasn't turning up. All of a sudden, I wasn't turning up for sessions. I wasn't the first on the bus. I was the one who had gone missing for 4 days and people were looking for me and management couldn't get hold of me. And my poor tour manager at the time was driving around different places. He knew that I drank to try and find me at different points. And my girlfriend, who is now my wife, you know, I can't still quite believe I've held on to her, but she was seeing all this happen, you know, and it was kind of, but to be honest, I knew I was in trouble, but I didn't want to face what was staring me in the face. You know, I just wanted to kind of deal with it, get people off my back and kind of move forward. So I went to a rehab clinic. You know, I checked myself in. I thought, I know what I'll do. I'll check myself into rehab. That'll show them that I'm willing, and you know, and maybe I'll clean myself up for a bit, get a couple of months, you know, away, a detox, you know, and that kind of thing. And then I'll be okay, you know, to go back to how I want to be, you know. And so I did that, and I came out and used immediately,
and straight away
within I think the next day I came out, had a takeaway, sat in my flat on my own. And then woke up the next morning, started drinking immediately. And it was...
Do you think there's... Sorry to interrupt. Do you think there's any correlation between... Because it's so similar to me. That thing of, as you say, having too much time by yourself, with your own head, with your own thoughts, that I came out of rehab the first time I went, probably lasted about 2 weeks.
Yeah.
And I was on my own. And that was it. Because it was like, it was too noisy. And because I didn't have anybody else particularly to have any responsibility toward, it was only me. And I felt so little about myself that it was like, it just got too much.
Yeah, that's such a...
Does that make sense?
That resonates so strongly with me. Yeah, it really kind of, you're right. It's about feeling so less about yourself that what's the point?
Yeah.
In some ways, you know, yeah, like I lasted, I remember also, I remember very vividly going, what the hell am I going to do every day? Yeah. You know, how am I going to, you know, what am I going to do with my life? Like everything I did was revolved around drink and drugs. And, you know, that was kind of my world and my life. You know, all my friends were like that. You know, everybody I knew was like that. The world that I lived in was like that. How am I going to, you know, I didn't know how to pay a bill. Or, you know, or like that was the last thing on my mind, actually. But like, I didn't know how to, you know, go to the shops and do normal person things. You know, like I was like, what do you do every day? Read? It's like, God, you know, like, And so I gave up really quickly, you know. But and then things, I managed to hide a lot from a lot of people for quite a while, you know, about the extent of what things were, you know. And then I went back in again, but then I was kind of, my hand was forced the second time. People rained down on me.
What can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, I was an absolute mess. Like the second time I went into rehab, it was getting really bad, and my solo album was still not complete, and like my everyone had spent a lot of money, you know, and I kind of signed a big deal, and it's kind of it was on me. I just wasn't getting my act together. I wasn't writing. I wasn't really turning up to studio sessions, and I was drunk all the time. And I remember like people sat me down, and it was a very strong arm, you know, to sort myself out. And so I was kind of forced to kind of go somewhere. And so I went somewhere. But once again, I didn't want to be there. I didn't want to do it. I didn't want to do it for myself. I was just doing it because it was a way to shut people up, you know, to get people off my back, to kind of, so I could then return to how I wanted to live my life, you know, which was my way, you know. And so I went in again, and then came out. But do you know what? This time, I think the thing was, the second time I went in, my ears, I'd learned a lot since the first time I went in there about my behavior. You know, the second time I went in, something happened where I actually started to listen to what they were saying. I was like, oh, shit, yeah, I think I have this. You know, I think I have what they're talking about. Mm-hmm. You know, which had never really crossed my mind before. I was like, this is just to get people off my back. But then, so when I went out again afterwards and I started doing what I was doing before I went in there, something had changed because I knew what I was doing and I knew I was acting that way rather than being oblivious to it. I knew I was acting alcoholically. I knew I was acting, you know, and that was almost all the fun then was taken away, you know, because it was no longer, it was no longer doing it and it was okay and it was cool, it was fun. It was always bad. It was always sad. It was always dark. And
lonely.
And very lonely. And to the point, exactly, like, I mean, that was one of the worst points, was that I was always ended up on my own, you know. And it was, and I had people who loved me and cared for me, but I would always end up on my own somewhere, sad and alone. You know, it was really dark and horrible. And then something happened. I something tripped in me, and I just had enough. And I knew I was, you know, I had some friends that, you know, were, you know, one friend had died, you know, of an overdose, who I knew, lots of other people had disappeared from my life, you know, and I didn't know where they were, and certain other things. And I think, and I was just getting worse and worse and worse. And I like every day I couldn't hide it anymore. So I was constantly in trouble. There was no way for me to function in normal life anymore. You know, like I couldn't pretend to be anybody. I was an alcoholic in every way, shape and form, at every part of the day, you know. And I had no way to kind of, I had no strength to keep hiding it. You know, it was becoming the hiding it, the constant, you know, trying to second guess everybody and all that kind of stuff was exhausting. And I was just like, and I was drinking in the morning. I was doing everything that I didn't want to do, you know, and I said I would never do. I was doing everything I said I was never going to do, I had done and was still doing, you know. And I just had enough, and I dropped to my knees and just, you know, I was like, I can't do this anymore. And I went to another recovery center in Bournemouth. It was fantastic, and I went there, and but I needed it. I really wanted to change, you know. I was like, do anything. I will do anything possible to be not me. You know, I didn't want to be who I was anymore, and I didn't know what else to do but to go there. And so I went there, and I listened, and I had a fantastic time. And I was getting married, and I think the trigger for me is that I'm going to turn up to my wedding off my head, guaranteed. There's no two ways about it. Like, I will, and she won't marry me, and everyone will see me for who I am, and it'll be, you know, I just could see it happening because there was no way I could stay sober. I couldn't stay sober for a couple of hours, so I went there, I came out, and I got married, and I was sober on my wedding day, and it was the most, if I'm honest, the most terrifying, weirdest day of my life. You know, I wanted this to be the most beautiful, amazing experience, and I love her to death, and it was. You know, we've since had a 10-year wedding anniversary, and I kind of and I haven't had a drink in that time, so I was able to really enjoy that moment for what it was. But if I'm honest, my wedding day was me gripping onto my seat, surrounded by people getting pissed, and I was just like, you know. So it wasn't quite the beautiful moment for me, but it was. But I could see in her face how amazing it was for her, and also for them to have me sober. You know, was a big deal. You know, so and I got married, and things went well for, you know, about 2 months, and then I relapsed again, and I relapsed in concession for about 4 months. I couldn't, and I was just trying to get a day, and I couldn't, and then. And I wasn't doing what anyone told me to. I wasn't doing anything that was suggested to me. And I started listening to other people for once, and I stopped listening to myself and stopped trying to do things my way. I listened to other people's suggestions and I followed them.
What were they, Matt? What kind of things were people saying to you?
Well, there's a self-help group which I'm a part of, and that was and there's things that are suggested in that self-help group which I just ignored. And I took from them sometimes what I wanted from them, and I left alone what I didn't want to, you know. And I probably took one thing from them and left the rest, you know. But I was powerless over alcohol and drugs. I was completely powerless. I had no power left in that, you know. So I listened to what was suggested to me, and I just shut up. And I didn't ask questions. I just went, I'm just going to do it your way for a while, you know, and just throw myself at this and see what happens. And one day led to another day, which 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 led to a week, a month, 6 months, a year.
I guess, was that one of the suggestions that people say, keep it in the day, the power of now, all that sort of stuff? Did you manage it like that?
I managed approach? It by the hour at the beginning.
By the hour, yeah, people talk about that too.
Yeah, I kind of, they said a day at a time, but a day felt like too long. You know, I remember always trying to get to 1 p.m., you know, because if I could get to 1 p.m., the day was kind of won for me. You know, and then the rest of the day I found a bit easier. But it was that first part of the day which I've just found that it was on me. The demon was on me every hour, and I was kind of but then once I get to 1 p.m., things just seem to get easier. And then after, you know, if I'm honest, after 2 or 3 weeks, that was much easier. You know, and then it was a point of keeping the day, and I would do things which I never thought I would do. You know, like I would get on my knees and pray for a sober day, you know, which I thought was crazy, you know, and I would do that in the morning because that's what I was told to do. And I did it, you know, and I didn't have any idea what I was praying to. I still don't now, you know, and I would get on my pillow at night and say thanks for keeping me sober today, whatever the hell I'm talking to, you know. And it was just about having something that was greater than myself in my life that I found that I could turn to and was a positive influence in my life.
Which wasn't your addiction.
That's the thing.
But what's so weird is what you've just said about, you know, I remember looking in the mirror and going, I can't see a way through 24 hours of being me.
Yeah.
So therefore I will drink because I don't think I can do 24 hours with my head doing this and the fear and all of that. And actually, when you, like you, I don't think I did recovery particularly well for quite a long time. Because I think there was always that thing going, oh no, play the game. You can say the right things. You know what to say. You're intelligent enough to know.
Yeah.
You know, the same voice that goes, you're not intelligent at all. You're stupid. You know, but finally, when you give in, it's the same thing. It's looking in the mirror and going, I can't do this. But instead of going, so therefore I'm going to get wasted. Yeah. I'm going to turn to people who know what they're talking about.
Yeah.
And I'm going to go into that as much as I went into the other thing.
Completely, yeah.
And it's so extraordinary about, you were saying about, you know, the tiring thing of trying to second guess people and remembering what you said or did the night before or who you phoned or all of those things.
Oh my God.
And it just lifts.
Yeah.
And it's such a relief.
Yeah, it is.
It's extraordinary.
And the thought of living life without alcohol in the beginning was so terrifying.
Yeah.
And so, and actually, when I look back, what I was doing before was so terrifying and so exhausting that this is so much easier, you know. And actually, like, and even at the beginning when I was gripping onto my chair, it was still easier than being in my head when I was in active addiction, you know. So it's a beautiful thing.
Yeah. Well, I thought what was really interesting when I was reading a bit about you on the internet, that you were saying, well, actually, I would have done these things even if I hadn't been a pop star or a rock and roller, whatever the term is, or a writer or an actor. You, I think you've said, haven't you, publicly, look, I think I now know enough about myself to know I've got this thing, which I'm now treating.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
Yeah.
When did you, I just find that fascinating because clearly people who are in the public eye are under pressure. They're in a world where there's a lot of kind of, what's the word?
Scrutiny.
Scrutiny, but also, like Matt said earlier, that permission to get wasted, that permission, you know, sex, drugs and rock and roll.
Yeah.
And hope I die before I get old and all this sort of stuff.
Yeah.
But so in some way you had a, you know, and you were in the jungle and you were in there. So were you sober when you did
No, okay. I wasn't. No, that was a very strange experience.
Was that difficult?
The first week of that, well, I tried to taper off before I went in. And the first week, like, you don't see me. Like my wife said, the first week we didn't see you at all on camera. It's because I was literally shaking physically, like withdrawing. Like the first 3 days, I remember being hellish. And I was in the jungle, it was so hot. I was just sat there sweating, just like, and I was not talking to anybody, keeping myself to myself. And then something happened, like a week in, I had no booze inside me. And suddenly I felt great. You know, and the final 2 weeks, I felt amazing. And then the rap party.
You smashed it.
I smashed myself to pieces, you know.
Oh,
yeah, so it's crazy.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
And but, how have you found the way that you've been treated by the British press? I say the British press because I think the American press have a slightly different opinion on it.
Yeah.
I think the British press have a need to know about the darkness of it all. They're not willing to celebrate recovery. They're not willing to let people say, I've done 10 years, I've done 20 years, I've done a year. They're much better at harking back to the bad stuff.
Yeah, that is exactly my experience. Like, I almost feel, you know, the thing is, with this stuff, like, I think it's important to spread a message of hope, right? And there is something about talking about where it was to talk about where it is now, which is important. But the problem with the press is that as soon as you mention, they don't care about what's happening now. They don't care about, like, how good that you had to go there to be where you are now. You can get the occasional story that might want to celebrate you in that way, but it's very rare. Usually they just want to find out those dark points.
Yeah.
And then it almost becomes like, for me, like, I've been things I've mentioned in the past have been spun. It almost sounds like I'm glamorizing that time in my life. Like, I'm like, oh God, how rock and roll am I? This is horrible, awful experiences in my life that, you know, I'm trying my best to get over, you know, and kind of become a better person, you know. But they, you know, I remember, like, when Busted was first around, like, when I was using and drinking in London, like the Sun at the time had like a bizarre column, which was like the celeb column. And I got a bit of a name for myself, and they had this corner of the paper which was called Beer Mat, which was me falling out of different nightclubs, and people thought that was cool. People thought that was awesome. You know, I didn't really mind it at the beginning. Mm-hmm. Look back at it now, and it's like, man, you know, you know. So it's people love to celebrate, you know, but like, you know, it's yes, yeah, it's I look back at it and I think, you know, would I do things differently? And I don't know if I ever could have.
Mm.
You know, I can now. Yeah. You know, but I look back and I couldn't then.
Well, we're almost there. Time has flown by, hasn't it?
Wow.
Certainly
has. Matt, I mean, I think you touched on it there at the end. I think, you know, people listening to this are going to get a lot of hope from your story. It's a powerful story. And as you say, you've earned your stripes in that way. And as you say, it's not so much something to be proud of, is it? That's your story. And I think, you know, hopefully people listening in, it's about, hopefully some of them anyway, identifying that I don't have to keep doing that.
Yeah.
I can put my hands up. I can say, listen, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like Fincy said, there's hope. I can be me without a drink or a drug.
Completely.
Strange as that sort of sounds at the time.
And also,
or
if
feels
you fail, you get up and you do it again.
Exactly. Yeah. That's what's so beautiful about this, I think.
Yeah.
And I've failed so many times, you know, but I keep going.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Mm.
Thanks
Long
so much, Matt.
Yeah, thank you. You too.
If you've enjoyed today's show, listening to Matt, please subscribe. And don't be scared to give us a 5-star rating. Please spread the word. It'd be very, very appreciated. Thanks very much.